You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Joe Tokawingawai no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Joe, I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by my producer, Arno. Arno, how's it going?
Hey, I'm well.
It is our first time on the Wednesday Wire.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Very excited. We've got a stacked show for you guys. Fi Akine coming up on the show. I'll be looking at temporary flood levies for higher earners due to damages caused by Cyclone Gabriel. I'll be speaking to Jonathan Barrett, Associate Professor in Commercial Law and Taxation at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. Stella speaks to Gabby Evans, a communications intern at Able, about the perspective of someone who's deaf and uses captions, as the Listen Up conference is happening very soon in Tamaki Makaurau. Arno, who do you speak to?
I speak to Professor Simon Malpas of the University of Auckland's Implantable Devices Group about one of the world's first brain implantable devices for people suffering from hydrocephalus.
Stella also speaks to Katia, Neef and Erin about the forced displacement of the Barnabin community and their ongoing human rights struggles, as well as a new art exhibition titled Justice for Rabi, the story of Barnaba. She also speaks to Jack, a Barnabin delegate, on this topic. Finally, I speak to Emma Carroll from the University of Auckland about climate change, pushing Tauroha southern whales to forage further for food. He aha o whakaro. We'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so please do get in touch. Tuki patui mai, you can text us in on 5395, or wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 09309 3879. Kau e wari wari e ahe ana koto te whakarongo ki ane kororo. Ano hei pakiheri rokiroki marunga e te pai tukutuku o e rangi poho. Mi haere ki 95 BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website. Now, into The Wire for Wednesday.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Cyclone Gabriel's trail of destruction has presented a major political dilemma for the government, that being how will Aotearoa pay for the damage. I spoke to Jonathan Barrett, Associate Professor in Commercial Law and Taxation at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, on this matter, and I started off by asking him why New Zealand is financially stuck between a rock and hard place.
Well, essentially, I think really following Adrian Orr's point that, you know, you've got this stark choice at the extremes between borrowing and raising taxes. Borrowing, therefore, potentially stoking inflation, and taxes being anti-inflationary. Now, of course, you know, governments don't have to face one or the other. And whatever happens, you know, even if the government were to go for a flood levy, it would only just be part of it, and obviously borrowing is going to be a major part of it. It's just getting the balance right. It's also about sending signals, I think. I think that's very important. The idea that we're all in this together, so it may be Northland or Te Rapiti today, but it could be Wellington tomorrow or Southland or whatever. And just that idea that in times of emergency, that we should all pitch in some way.
Borrowing has been on the cards for the government as of late. Why could this be a good thing, but also why could this be a bad thing?
I think, you know, we've been borrowing so much of late. Money's not as cheap as it used to be, and it has to be paid back at some stage. And, you know, that gets spread over years, potentially generations. And I'm particularly concerned about building up paying current costs and spreading that over, you know, the next generations. We've got some major problems down the line in terms of funding superannuation and healthcare, particularly as the population ages. We just seem to be shifting more and more of that burden onto the next generations in the hope that they'll solve it. But the reality is they could simply be facing too great a tax burden. So we need to consider intergenerational equity, essentially.
Now, while increasing taxes, on the other hand, could be a more politically attractive option, especially heading into this year's election, that making borrowing the more politically attractive option as well, there is a burden of repaying capital and interest, and this could be spread over several years. With the damage of Cyclone Gabrielle being in the billions, there's also numerous other financial situations that Aotearoa must deal with. I guess when it comes to increasing taxes, what could be the pros and cons of this?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a huge political risk for the Labor government in raising taxes, where you have a national opposition that say they're going to cut taxes. You know, and people, you know, think about self-interest. You know, we all try to be good, but when it comes down to it, if one party is saying we're going to raise taxes, then that may be unattractive for a lot of people. So there's got to be a good persuasive argument put forward by government if it is going to raise taxes. And the flood levy is quite attractive in a way, because it's something that's very real at the moment. You know, you only have to turn on the TV or look at a newspaper, listen to the radio, to see how dreadful the impact has been in parts of the country. So it's something that's very real at the moment. It's not something that you have to imagine, like superannuation funds in 20 years' time. It's something very real and visceral. And if we put a temporary flood levy for a year, like Judith Gillard did for Queensland, you know, I think people can see it's got that sunset clause, etc. So it could be presented as an attractive option.
Which taxes would be increased or introduced? You've mentioned a shift to carbon taxation may be needed, a punitive tax on forestry companies, given the role of slash in the cyclone damage.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, looking realistically, the only place we can go is some kind of levy on income tax. New taxes would take years to really put together and to embed. So that I don't think there's that realistic. You know, in the long term, obviously, we want to shift from taxing people's effort into taxing their carbon outputs. You know, that's a long term. That's a big shift in the way we think and the way we design our economy. So that's an ideal down the line. But at the moment, the only immediate possibility really is to put a levy on income tax. And whether we should put it on companies as well, you know, that's obviously open for debate. I didn't consider that. But we do live in a competitive environment for company tax rates. So I think there'll be great sensitivity for government on that. But if we look at income tax, roughly $55 billion in income tax, if we put a 0.5% surcharge on the wealthier people, we could expect to be bringing in, you know, at least $1 billion on that, which would go some way to fixing or contributing to fixing the problems that have been caused by Gabrielle. The other thing, too, is that the other main tax that we have for individuals is GST, and in my view, that's already too high. We shouldn't be going there. It disproportionately impacts on the less wealthy already. So it's income tax that's really the only option.
Now, my last question, you've also mentioned how in the years ahead, it's important that we must debate how taxes may alleviate the harm suffered by people and businesses after these extreme weather events, as well as look at reducing carbon emissions. Is there anything else that the government must take into account, especially heading into this year with the elections?
I mean, if the government weren't a political party, I'd say those are the key ones, you know, sort of prudently preparing for the future, getting the tax system right, etc. But, you know, there's reality. You have to get elected if you want to do those things. And so, you know, I'm fortunate. You know, I'm an academic. I don't have to get elected, unlike, you know, Chris Hipkins or Grant Robertson. So for them, it would be a very difficult decision. I recognise that. And, you know, governments don't always or can't politically always make the right decision.
That was Jonathan Barrett, Associate Professor in Commercial Law and Taxation at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, speaking about flood levy taxation and borrowing.
Ah!
The Wire.
Friday, March 3rd marks World Hearing Day, and one celebration is the Listen Up Conference, where the CEO of Able, Dan Buckingham, will be speaking. Today, 95BFM digital sub-editor Stella Huggins speaks to communications intern at Able, Gabriella Evans, who is deaf and a caption user, about her experience with accessing media and the importance of nothing about us without us, a mantra used to communicate the idea that no policy should be decided by any representative without the full indirect participation of members of the groups affected by said policy. Here they are now.
So what Able is we are an organisation that provides access to deaf and blind or low vision people in the form of audio descriptions and captions.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey with deafness? Do you remember getting your cochlear implants and what was that like for you?
So I was born deaf, but I wasn't diagnosed until I was 2 years old. And then I used a hearing aid throughout my life until I was about 18 when I got my cochlear implants, and that was in 2016.
So you are bilingual. Can you tell us about learning New Zealand Sign Language?
I didn't, like, grow up signing or anything. Well, originally when I was a really small child, I did sign, but that was sort of... It was through a method called Makaton / the Johansen method, and that was more of like a pathway or a bridge to eventually speaking. But that was what was decided for me at the time, and then once I went into school, I basically forgot all the sign language I even had. And so that went on for about 10 years, and then when I was 14, I moved up to Auckland to attend Kelson Deaf Education Centre, which is now called Takureo. Because I was boarding there as well, a lot of the deaf staff at the boarding school were deaf and used NZSL, so I learned from them and other students. So it was a full immersion environment.
So how has your own experience influenced your understanding of the importance of accessibility in life in general?
So I can speak to that a little bit about sort of captions and my experience at KDEX. So growing up, you know, I was a 2000s kid. So especially 2000s kid in rural New Zealand where it was dial-up, okay? So we really did not have access to Google. We knew it was a thing, but we didn't really use it to look up and know things. So... the only real kind of access to TV or knowing even what was going on TV was the TV guide. And unfortunately, the TV guide at the time basically had nothing about how to access teletext, which was how people accessed captions back in the day. And it was not until I went to KDEC that I discovered how to use captions and even turn on teletext, because it was through the deaf adults working there and the other deaf students sort of passing on that knowledge, like being really eager to go, this is how you do it. You know, you just pick up the remote, punch in this code, and it would come on the TV, and it was like, wow, I did not know this. And so something that small actually changed a lot of things for me.
So on that note, the Listen Up Conference is happening on World Hearing Day, and it's an incentive for organisations to really look at how they're thinking about diversity and inclusion. How can more workplaces become inclusive of the deaf culture and employees?
So first things I would say is if you have a deaf employee or a client or someone you're working with regularly, they might have already come to you and sort of said, hey, this is... what works for me, and, you know, explained their situation. But I would always say, you know, just be open to, like, having basically like an open door policy, I guess, just to say, you know, come and talk to me anytime if there's something that is not going quite right for you, or if you would like this to be changed. You know, basically just make it known that you're willing to work with them.
And so what advice would you give to listeners or our audience in general about how to interact with people who are deaf or hard of hearing?
If it's not like a regular kind of environment like the workplace, say if you just had a deaf customer come into your store, this will not be that person's first kind of dance in that. And let them take the lead. Like, if they show, you know, what they want on their notes app on their phone, or if they ask for pen and paper, let them take the lead because they will have experienced it many times. This might be your first time, but for them it will be their one of many times, so they'll be well-versed in how to do it.
How would you see the conversation about accessible media evolving in the future, or what do you think progress might look like in this area?
So at Able, our vision is for Aotearoa to be a place where everyone has equal access to media, whether that be the deaf or blind and low vision communities, because having access to media is really important, even just to know what's going on around you, and that one media is one of many ways.
That was Gabriella Evans, a communications intern at Able who is deaf, speaking with 95BFM's digital sub-editor Stella Huggins about Able captioning for deaf people. There will also be a full transcript of this interview for accessibility later, so please do keep an eye on the website for that. You're on The Wire for Wednesday. Remember, you can get in touch with us, 5395, to text us, 09309 3879 to give us a call. Let us know what you think of all the pieces you have heard so far. We'll be right back after a short break.
We don't agree with violence. We do not agree with the government. Nah, we do.
The Wire.
Performing in New Zealand for the first time in 5 years, Lord. Live at the Outer Fields at Western Springs, March 4th. Long-awaited tour.
From pure heroin to melodrama to solar power.
Though we're fine with this, we didn't come for money.
Don't miss Lord.
With special guests Marlon Williams, Phaser Days and Ricky Reed.
March 4th at the Outer Fields at Western Springs. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Put on an event during one of AUSA's themed weeks and they'll pay for everything. Pride Week is kicking off on April 3rd, so if you have a great idea for a gay old time, then hit them up. Just make sure it's free for all students, targeted at least 50 people, and it's queer as hell. Submissions are due on March 8th. Just fill out the proposal on the last page of the tender booklet or email engagementvp@ausa.org.nz.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Botico Beats with Enrique Morales and guests with support by Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
the Leonard Charles Trio featuring Jeremy Toy, Chip Matthews and Tom Broom with the Sami Sisters and DJs Colotta and Momo.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Harvey Sutherland, Mildlife, Lady Hawk, Mara TK, Nice Girl and loads more. Live at Rangihoa Estate for Flamingo Pier Waiheke.
If you want to win tickets to this groovy getaway weekend, just grab your B-card and stay tuned to 95BFM all this week for your cue to enter.
95BFM presents Flamingo Pier Waiheke, March 3rd to the 5th at Rangihoa Estate. Tickets from flamingopier.net.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire for Wednesday. I will now pass it over to Arno.
Hydrocephalus is a disease with 100 New Zealand patients diagnosed every year. A recent funding injection of $6 million into the world's first implantable long-term brain pressure sensor promises relief for New Zealanders and also those across the globe. I spoke with Professor Simon Malpass, who is leading research at the Implantable Devices Group at the University of Auckland. I spoke with him to find out more about this research and what it means for New Zealanders as well as a global population. I started off by asking for an explanation of what hydrocephalus is.
Yeah, it's a condition characterized by too much fluid around the brain. And this can be from our brains are bathed in this cerebral spinal fluid, and it goes down the spinal cord. It's about, you know, it's not that much, a couple of hundred mils at the most. And we produce about half a litre a day. So our cells produce it, and normally it's produced and excreted. And when there's too much produced, the pressure rises, and that's where the word hydro, water, and it's in the ventricles, those gaps in the brain where the brain cells aren't, and there's a gap there, there's ventricles, and then there's too much fluid accumulates, and it squashes on the brain tissue and the blood vessels, and that's where we get the problems occurring.
How does a long-term brain pressure sensor help patients with hydrocephalus?
Yeah, so really the problem is that these patients, they can be children, they can be older people as well after a tumour or a trauma. So it's all ages can be affected. And what happens is a neurosurgeon will put in a tube, a shunt, that will go from the gap in the brain, the ventricle, right down to the stomach to drain the excess fluid away. And the problem is that those shunts have the highest failure rate of almost any medical device. And that means that fails in children at an alarming rate. 50% will fail in the first couple of years. And so when that happens, those poor kiddies will have these headaches, they'll get nausea, they might get vomiting, or they might just get irritable and lose energy. So those symptoms are really hard for parents and physicians to say whether that's the shunt blocking up and beginning not to work and too much fluid in the brain, or is that something else? So the real unmet clinical need is to help parents, physicians, monitor the pressure in the brain to know when the shunt is working. So our technology is all designed to reduce anxiety and improve the clinical outcomes for these patients.
How big is the device and where in the brain is it implanted?
Yeah, good question. So it's pretty small, so it's 2 millimeters by 3 by 20, so it's long and long, not too long, but very skinny. And it's implanted at the same location as where the tube, the shunt, is put in. So the shunt passes through the cortex, so on the top of the brain or the back side of the brain, and it passes through that, and the shunt goes into the gap, the ventricle. Our device just goes into what we call the cortex, so the first top layer of the brain tissue, and it sits just at the level of the top of the cortex.
What are the major milestones you've achieved during the last few years of research?
Yeah, so really the last, and we've been working on this project as a concept for 8 years with some of the neurosurgeons at Auckland City Hospital, initially until we could get funding. And really the funding, which has been MB, Health Research Council, and other charitable bodies, has really been around how do you make an accurate pressure measurement? How do you make that accurately? And how do you ensure that it's stable long term? And so the milestones have really been around with some of the team that have really been, and they're experts in micro machining and making really, really small electronic components, about reducing the size and getting it really accurate. So the milestones really have been around showing that the device is safe for implantation. You know, you don't produce a whole lot of heat, that it's accurate, and it's safe to go in an MRI or a CT scan that people often have. So it's all been around safety and performance have been the major milestones more recently as we are moving towards hopefully doing our first patients early next year.
Does this technology have any implications for other fields of neurology and or diseases?
Yeah, so it certainly does. And our intent all the way along is that we would take this hydrocephalus as the first cab off the rank, first clinical indication. It's really strong unmet clinical need, but there are other clinical indications where pressure in a particular region of the body is raised. So we're talking about hydrocephalus, brain pressure being elevated, bad thing. But if you go to something like heart failure is often characterized at certain stages by a lot of breathlessness, a lot of congestion in the pulmonary side of the circulation around the lungs, and that fluid accumulates. So a lot of the time, cardiologists are trying to make sure that people aren't becoming more congested, more breathless. And when that goes wrong, they'll often end up in hospital while they try and get their drug therapy modified so that they can get rid of the extra fluid. So we also know that if we can monitor pressure in the pulmonary circulation in heart failure, we can also help those patients. So the whole idea, remember, is how can we keep people at home, away from hospital, not needing to come into hospital by this remote monitoring of pressure. That's the broad theme.
What are the next steps for the hydrocephalus microbrain implant?
Yeah, so the next steps for our program is we are rushing as fast as we can through a lot of the safety testing that we're still concluding, because, you know, this will be the first time anyone's put a discrete microcomputer directly in the brain and then pushed power into it and then pulled out the pressure values out of it so that the wireless power goes in and the pressure values come out. So that's pretty novel worldwide to do that. So we really, really, really want to be sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure it's safe. So our milestones are this year. It's finishing off all of the safety testing, the biocompatibility, the bench testing, MRI, all those things, and then planning for our first patients early next year as soon as we can. So that's the broad sort of trajectory. And those patients will be Auckland City Hospital who are coming through needing their shunts to be revised.
You mentioned wireless charging. So is it type of induction device placed on top of the skin to power this implant?
Yeah, exactly. So you got it in one. So we use, the device has no battery in it, no moving part. The implant has no moving parts, no battery. And that's great for longevity. We all know our mobile phone batteries don't last as well as they used to over time. But is it, the implant has a very, very tiny coil inside it. And so what we do is we create an inductive field on the outside using what we call a wand. It's basically a handheld a device that has a ring, and that creates the magnetic field. And then it will power the device for about up to 10 centimeters away. So it's no wires, no cables. And that data, it pushes power in, and then it actually receives back the pressure values, and then those pressure values go to the wand. They're displayed for the patient, and they go up to onto an app as well, so the patient can add in on their symptoms or just track their health diary as well.
That was Professor Simon Malpass of the University of Auckland's Implantable Devices Group on the recent innovations in brain implants for those suffering from hydrocephalus.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
In the mid-20th century, hundreds of Barnabans were displaced from Barnaba Island to Fiji's Rambi Island due to the devastating impacts of phosphate mining. Today, Barnabans on Rambi continue to face discrimination as a partially self-governing entity falling between the cracks of Fiji and Kiribati. Their stories remain largely unheard in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where the benefits of mining allowed the British to advance their colonisation and kickstart New Zealand's agricultural sector. 95BFM digital sub-editor Stella Huggins speaks to Katia Futaraksa Neef and Erin about the forced displacement of the Barnaban community and their ongoing human rights struggles, as well as their new art exhibition titled Justice for Rambi, The Story of Barnaba. She also speaks to Jack, a Barnaban delegate, on this topic. Here they are now.
In the early 1900s, the British Phosphate Company found phosphate in a few places in the Pacific, including Barnaba, which is sort of the story that we're telling here. And the British Phosphate Company then became jointly owned by the British, Australian, and New Zealand governments, which is the New Zealand connection there. The British Phosphate Company then went on to mine 90% of the island's surface on Barnaba, and then in 1945 forcibly relocated the Barnaban community to an island in Fiji, Rambi Island, where most Barnabans live now. They have a population of about 5,000, and there's currently a resident sort of caretaker population on Barnaba of about 200 Barnabans at this time, but it's quite inhospitable conditions to live on Barnaba. Obviously, it's been mined very intensely for almost a century, and that is the backstory there. And the phosphate that was mined from Barnaba was used to prop up the growing settler population in New Zealand, which is the connection there. So we all sort of benefit from the use of the phosphate from Bonaba for agriculture as in the form of fertilizer here in New Zealand.
The Bonaba Ocean Island is a high limestone phosphate atoll between the westernmost edge of Kiribati and Nauru in the northern Pacific Ocean. The island is located approximately 400 kilometers from Kiribati and 300 kilometers from Nauru. It has historically been inhabited by the Banaban people, an indigenous group with a distinct culture and one of the few ethnic in the Pacific that had individual of land. The Banaban people were forcibly displaced from the island in the mid-20th century due to the devastating impacts of phosphate mining.
So where did the funding come from for this work, and how are you implementing that funding to share the stories of the Banaban people?
Yeah, so we have funding from a few different places. We have the bulk of the funding from Creative New Zealand, and their funding is going towards making the exhibit possible, so the installation of the actual works, commissioning artworks, as well as the bulk of the travel for our delegation of 11 guests from Rambi, 8 Bonaban dancers, including a choreographer, and 3 representatives from the Rambi Council who will be arriving on Saturday. So that's from Creative New Zealand. We also have small grants from UNESCO New Zealand, the Taiwan Foundation for Democracy, and Amnesty International. And that's helping to fund all of the other bits and pieces to make the exhibit possible. And there's also a component from Creative New Zealand that's paying for translation of the report. So obviously there's a key advocacy component of this work as well, not only telling these stories, but also connecting it to some of the key demands from the Rambi community in particular. And so that report that was done jointly by ICAD, representatives of the Rambi Council, and our pro bono law firm partner, Clifford Chen, will be translated to the Kiribati language, which is a part of that funding as well.
How did you ensure that you were sort of a vessel, so to speak, for their stories rather than an imposing presence taking their stories and redistributing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And Katya and I have been asking ourselves, we've been checking ourselves on this question over and over again. So the approach that we took on Rambi was to record interviews so we can actually just sort of literally be the vehicle to take those stories and then to just project them literally on screens here in the silo. And we obviously asked for permission and asked how they wanted them to be shared, if they wanted them to be shared in one way. There's a great quote, and we heard it from multiple interviewees saying that they were happy to be interviewed and for it to be recorded on the condition that it's shared with the world. And bringing the delegation here, connecting them with key players, key development partners as well, and allowing them to share their stories directly with the media at our event. And in our communications as well.
How do you feel that it's best for the citizens of Aotearoa, or anywhere really, to engage with this content and honour Rabi's story and experience?
Well, they should know about the Banaban. Well, they were moved to another island from Banaban, so this is to show them that we should be the last people to be relocated from our land, is to tell them that we should be the last group of people.
Yeah, and in the face of climate change, there's going to be probably more displacement and relocation in the future, and we want the story of Rambi and the story of Banaba to not be forgotten, as we don't want this to happen in the future where people lose their land, lose their identities and their language due to mining or climate change, and we don't want this story to be forgotten or put into the past, but remembered. And also, this is an ongoing issue and there are human rights violations, and we need to make sure that we protect their right to life with dignity on Rambi and also on Banaba. Yeah, I think the first step is learning this history. It's really important not only to know sort of how it implicates sort of the history of the lands that we're currently on and the stories of how we're able to be here and how there's such a large, obviously, settler colonial population here at all, but also as we think about climate displacement going forward and what it means to be displaced and how to live and how to accommodate living a life with dignity in new places and what that actually looks like and what some of those barriers are. So learning not only the history, but also what it means for us as we move forward is really important. But there are also direct ways that people can support by donating to the Bonavent Women's Organization. One of the challenges that has come up that the Rambi community faces is sort of a lack of development assistance by the nature of their semi-autonomous state under the Fiji government. So any donations in Koha go a long way to supporting the work that they're doing to preserve their cultural identity and obviously basic human rights outcomes as well. We'll also have an open letter coming out with the key demands from the Rambi community, and then as much support and sharing about the exhibit so that more people can come through. Probably the easiest list for people just to spread the word. We'll have a virtual exhibit that will be launched as well, continuing to share these stories not only in Auckland but around the world. So that's a great way that people can share and spread the word.
That was 95BFM digital sub-editor Stella Huggins speaking to Katia Futadaksa Neef, Erin and Barnabin delegate Jack about the forced displacement of the Barnabin community and their ongoing human rights struggles, as well as their new art exhibition titled Justice for Rabi, The Story of Banaba. You're on the wire for Rapa Wednesday. Remember, you can get in touch 5395 or give us a call on 09309 3879. Let us know what you think of all the pieces you've heard so far. We'll be right back after a short break.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire. Put on an event during one of AUSA's themed weeks and they'll pay for everything. International Week kicks off May 8th, so this is your cue to get cultural. Just make sure that your event is free for all students, targeted at least 50 people, and deep into the heritage, customs and food of Auckland Uni's diverse campus. Submissions are due March 8th. Just fill out the proposal on the last page of the tender booklet or email engagementvp@ausa.org.nz.
Kurt Vile. You know, early 40s, long hair, cute nose, always playing the guitar. Yeah. Well, he's coming to play that guitar at the Town Hall and we're giving away tickets. So, just get your B-card number and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive for your cue to enter. 95BFM presents Kurt Vile, live at the Auckland Town Hall, March 23rd. Tickets from Ticketmaster. I woke
up this morning. 15 years old, eh? I remember when you were just knee-high to a nut bush. True, true, yeah, absolutely. You doing much to celebrate? Same old, eh? The whole month? You're a real friend, Ponsonby Social Club. Stay fresh, yeah?
The same old Ponsonby Social Club is celebrating 15 years of being the most iconic bar on the strip with a month-long lineup of absolutely stellar music. Ponsonby Social Club's 15th birthday, all this month. Check out the full lineup at ponsonby.social.
Greetings, girl, and welcome to my world of phrasing right up to bat. It's the daisy age, and you're about to walk top stage, so wipe your lottos on the mat. Hip-hop love, this is, and don't mind when I quiz your evolvements before the sun. But clear your court, cause this a one-man sport, and who's better for this than plugged one? Plugged don't one. Have to worry about me squashing other deals, cause they've already been squished. Freeze a frame of our moves the same, wish we can continue right behind the bush. You'll stay with me, I know this, but not because of all my earthly treasures, or regardless to the fact that I'm past the noose, but because... This dance to introduce myself as the chosen one to speak. Let me lay my hand across yours and aim a kiss upon your cheek. The name's Plug 2, and from the soul I bring you the daisy of your choice. May it be filled with a pleasure principle in circumference to my voice. About those other Jennies I reckoned with, lost them all like a homework excuse. This time the magic number is 2, cause it takes 2, not 3 to seduce. My destiny of love is brought to an apex. Sex is a mere molecule in this world of lust that I have for you. It's true, true. Now it's time to let this rhyme style get somewhat poured in the mold. Hold my hand, we'll pick my plantation of daisies for a bouquet of souls. Like at the cut of a rim, take it as filled to the rim as in brim. Squeeze your stoop like Betty Boop, then make camel alphabet soup and spell plug ones within. Forward march is the same when transistors will play. Coming to bed is the move. Dolby sound will be then top crown when I put the needle into your groove. I got a good thing, and in full swing. I show this in gifts, words or letters, but even without those three, I know you'd be close to me, cuz. And the soul that I send is taking steps to reach your heart. Any moment you feel alone, I can fill up your empty part. We can ascend till we reach daylight heaven, and in a spin we'll hit the top 10. Then we could meet Mr. Stucky and Pop's brother Lucky will preach, let the wedding begin. Shot by an arrow of Cupid through a string of a G-clef, my dear, I claim your death. And if you could hear me, by golly G, true Goy is ready for what you possess. We could live in my plug tube home, and on Mars where we could be all alone. And we make a song for two, picture perfect things, and I sing of how
I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday, our final piece of the show. Tohora, or southern right whales, are searching further north and south for food across the Southern Ocean. The researchers say the changes happened over the past 30 years after a long period of remarkable consistency in whale feeding ranges dating back to the 1700s. I spoke to one of the researchers, Emma Carroll, from the University of Auckland, on this topic.
Yeah, we were able to take advantage of historical whaling records. So the Yankee whalers, the American whalers, visited the Southern Ocean as early as 1792. So we were able to look at whaling records from up to four centuries ago to compare to our current results.
Now, you've found that change has happened over the past 30 years and after a long period of remarkable consistency in whale feeding ranges, obviously dating back to the 1700s. Could you tell me about this consistency?
We found that mid-latitude foraging grounds, so around 40 degrees south to 50 degrees south, were used a lot by the whales during the whaling era. So, you know, 1800s to 1900s. But also we find that they're very well used by populations today as well. So that's really reassuring. It means that these regions are probably doing quite well in terms of ecosystems. They're still productive. There's still a lot of food there for our whales and other species like seabirds and seals, which is really reassuring. However, we do see changes in the high-latitude foraging of these whales. So that's kind of around Antarctica, 60 degrees south and higher. And the interesting thing is that the change in the use of these high-latitude areas really varies depending on where you are in the world. So if we look at the southwest Atlantic, so those are Tohora populations in South Africa and Brazil, they actually show a decrease in the use of these high-latitude foraging areas over the last 30 years. And in contrast, if you look at here, Aotearoa New Zealand and in Southeast Australia, we actually see a slight increase in the use of these high latitude areas over the last 30 years. And when we take a step back and have a look at what's going on with what these whales eat and how their ecosystems are changing, this makes sense because the Southwest Atlantic is one of the most rapidly warming places in the world, whereas actually south of New Zealand and around Antarctica is actually quite cool still. So we see changes in their foraging or feeding habits that make sense in terms of climate change where these animals live. And it's quite reassuring in some respects because these whales are actually adapting and changing what they're doing in response to the climate.
Changes in the availability of krill and other small crustaceans which tohora feed on, likely being in relation to climate change. Could you tell me a bit about this?
Yeah, so krill is the mainstay of what these whales eat when they are far south. In fact, krill is basically the keystone species in the Antarctic environment. But we know that they're quite sensitive to changes in temperature. And so if the oceans are warming, that we know that their krill populations will decline. But what's really interesting is if we look at the mid-latitudes, you know, they're probably eating what are called copepods. These are another kind of small plankton species. But the plankton in the mid-latitudes don't seem to be as sensitive to changes in temperature as krill are. So that's reassuring because it suggests that those mid-latitude foraging grounds potentially could maintain could still be stable into the future.
Now, is there any area of your research which you'd like to explore further?
Yeah, so we are also putting satellite trackers on tohora from New Zealand and Australia, and colleagues are also doing that in South America and South Africa. So that is actually going to let us not just look at where those whales are feeding, but what kind of ocean features that they're looking at, so, you know, upwellings or currents. And that will help us better understand exactly how they're using their environment and what cues that they're looking at.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add that we haven't spoken about already?
Well, you can follow the voyages of the whales or tohora that we've satellite tracked at www.tohoravoyages.ac.nz.
That was Emma Carroll from the University of Auckland speaking about how tohora, or southern right whales, are searching further north and south for food across the Southern Ocean, which may be linked to climate change.
That was The Wire.
Ko ere te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa. E kōrero mau kia mō tēnei rā. That is a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Jonathan Barrett, the Associate Professor in Commercial Law and Taxation at Te Heringa Waka, Victoria University of Wellington. Gabriella Evans from Able, who spoke with 95BFM's digital sub-editor Stella Huggins. Arno, who did you speak with today?
I spoke to Professor Simon Malpas from the University of Auckland's Implantable Devices Group.
We also had Katia Neef, Erin, and Barnabin delegate Jack, who also spoke with 95BFM's digital sub-editor Stella Huggins. And finally, Emma Carroll from the University of Auckland. Nei ra hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You are listening to 95BFM. We'll see you tomorrow for the Thursday Wire. Ma te wa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.